This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll be joined by Frances Golden, Debbie Smith, and our own Michael Stephen Smith, editors of the new book, Imagine, Living in a Socialist USA.
If you're worried about our future, and I'm sure you are, this book will give you hope and the belief that we can change our society. Read it.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights. Heidi, in the past on our show, we've covered the dire situation of Russell Maroon Schotz, the fact that he's been in solitary for, I think, now over 20 years. And there's some changes going on, we hope. Can you talk about that a little bit, Heidi? Maybe some, I won't say good news, but better news?
Well, relatively good news, Michael. And to remind listeners, we've had Russell's daughter, Teresa Schotz, on our show, as well as Brett Grody, who is an advocate in the state of Pennsylvania for unjust conditions in confinement. And the good news is Brett has let us know that last week, Russell was transferred from the state correctional institution Frackville, where Mumia Abu-Jamal is, to SCI Greaterford, which is in southeastern Pennsylvania. And that's what's called the Level 4. It's the highest level, maximum security prison. It currently holds slightly less than 4,000 inmates, the most in the entire Pennsylvania Department of Corrections. It also holds the most prisoners serving life without parole in Pennsylvania.
How can this be good news? I mean, you're telling a Level 4 maximum security prison? I read that in the note you sent me. I was pretty shocked by that.
Well, let's look at the conditions under which Russell has been held. He's been in solitary confinement for over two decades. This is an older gentleman who many believe has been held in solitary because he had a political background, and many saw him as kind of an intellectual leader. No infractions. Many, many years ago, he did escape. Three times he escaped. But he's otherwise been a model inmate and truly a lovely individual. And many of us have had the honor of meeting him and really quite a thinker and a gentle person. But anyway, back to the update. It's worth noting that Maroon has just completed what's called a step-down program at Frackville. He'd been transferred there from SCI Green, where he'd been also in solitary confinement. Lawyers from the Department of Corrections have told Maroon's legal counsel that prison officials intend to recommend, and this is the good news, his removal from the restricted release list to the Pennsylvania DOC Central Office. They've said that all prison officials involved in the decision-making process support Russell's release into general population at long last, and that he may be out of solitary confinement in approximately a month. But we take this with a grain of caution, and I think our listeners should hold their breath until he's in general population. Maroon has been told at two different prisons just in 2013 alone, that was Mahanoy and Frackville, that both intended to release him into the general population, only to see him transferred, and his release subject to great delay. So we're asking supporters of Russell, please remain vigilant, send lots of love to him and his family and supporters. If you write to him or if you plan a visit, please strictly adhere to all prison protocol in this rather sensitive waiting moment.
Heidi, if I wanted to write to Russell, how would I do that? Where do I get the address?
We'll put a link to Russell's website on the Law and Disorder website. We've highlighted in the last year Russell's wonderful book that our listeners can also get a hold of. We highly recommend that. And let's keep our fingers crossed for some really wonderful news.
That's a very good step. Let's hope it really happens, Heidi. So thank you very, very much. While we're talking about prisoners and where people are in prison, Jeremy Hammond has finally been moved to his more or less permanent place where he'll be perhaps for the next 8 or 9 years. 8 years, I hope, or less, much less. Anyway, you can write to him, Jeremy Hammond. Go to his website, freejeremy.net. He's in Manchester, Kentucky, at a medium security prison. According to the website, he's satisfied with the choice of prisons he was put into. It's a medium security. He would have liked it closer to his home in Chicago, but compared to what they might have done to him, I think Jeremy feels okay about it. So go to the Free Jeremy website, and you'll be able to write to him. Please do. He is starting his official relatively long sentence right now, very long sentence.
And those letters mean a lot. Michael Ratner, there have been calls increasingly that this government give clemency to Mr. Snowden. What's the latest on that?
Well, there's been a lot of interesting calls. We even had a man who was heading the NSA team that was looking into the revelations that Snowden made, calling for clemency. And he may be the head of the NSA next. He was doing it, which in an interesting way, he was worried that Snowden is sitting on piles of documents and that maybe they can make a deal with Snowden, give him some kind of clemency, amnesty, whatever they want to call it, and then maybe he won't reveal more information. Obviously, the journalists have the information they're going to reveal, so they're going to do what they do. But there was an implication that Snowden has a huge number more documents. So you even have people in the government saying perhaps we ought to deal with this because the damage can be so great in their view. I don't believe that's the case, but that's their view. On the other hand, at the same time, we saw the New York Times in a half a page editorial and the Guardian in a roughly the same length editorial demand or request or say that Snowden deserves clemency or a very short sentence. And obviously, it's moved a lot in this country in terms of him and the perception of him. And we all think that's very important. For me, not just because I'm the lawyer for WikiLeaks and Julian Assange, but because I think there's an underlying political issue between people calling for clemency only for Snowden, but not including Chelsea Manning, Jeremy Hammond, Julian Assange, and other whistleblowers and publishers. And the problem for me is they are looking at Snowden, they can give that to, but they won't ever consider that for the other people I've just mentioned. And my view is it's absolute that you have to ask for clemency for all of them. And I'm trying to analyze for myself. I tried, what are the differences? Why has one gotten so much publicity and support, and why have the others, at least in the United States, not? I mean, you go outside the United States, and WikiLeaks has a huge amount of support. In the United States, it's different. And of course, if we look at the nature of the revelations, in one case, Snowden's revelations are all about what's happening to you and I, the surveillance of Americans. And it's surveillance. It's privacy. It's surveillance. You look at what Chelsea Manning revealed. It's about U.S. running torture centers in Iraq, thousands of deaths from collateral murder, total hypocrisy and criminality in our dealings in diplomacy, secret wars and killings going on over the world. So two levels. One is Chelsea Manning's work, WikiLeaks and others, is really about what we're doing to other people. In this case, many of them Muslims, actually, but what we're doing to other people. Snowden's is really about what's happening to us and surveillance. And I don't think it's not that I would want to say one should get it and one shouldn't, but I'm saying if you're going to give clemency to Snowden, these others deserve it as well. And for me personally, I think ending the killing machine that is this country is what we are trying to do, or I am trying to do. And I think that's what Chelsea Manning's work helps us do. And so I just want to urge people, when you say support clemency for Snowden, also make sure you support clemency for the others.
I would just add to that, there's a domestic and a foreign element to this as well, but the ubiquity, really, of the NSA spying through all of our personal devices is one that really does impact nearly every American, and I think that touches, as you say, a little more closely to home.
Now, yes, that's clearly right. It affects everybody, so people are very concerned by that. But, you know, when we saw all of the revelations of Chelsea Manning, from the collateral murder video to everything else, there hasn't been one prosecution of a U.S. official for any of the murders that have taken place in Afghanistan or Iraq. Nothing about the secret wars, no stopping of drones. And you don't see people saying, look, Chelsea Manning revealed all this. Why aren't we pardoning Chelsea Manning? And that's what I'd like to see.
Two things, Michael. One is Senator Bernie Sanders from Vermont asked the NSA if they were spying on Congress, and the NSA refused to answer. So we know, I mean, talk about violation of democratic rights. They're not only spying on us, they're spying on our elected representatives. And then the other thing is that Obama appointed a commission to look into what we should do about all this spying. At the same time, there was a federal judge who said the NSA spying was patently illegal, Orwellian. He didn't enjoin it, but it would go up on appeal. But you had a federal judge, a conservative federal judge, saying you can't do this. So this is all coming down, and Obama's on the defensive. He said, well, I'm going to make a speech. By the time you hear this broadcast, the speech will have been made. My prediction, and I'm sure all of you agree with me, is that he's not going to do very much because under a lot of pressure from the secret police establishment to not do very much. So there'll be a lot of smoke and mirrors in this speech, and we're going to talk about it after it's delivered. But I think that we're stuck with what they're doing.
Well, Obama has already announced that he does not support handing over, as the five-member panel recommended, the records to be under the jurisdiction of the telecommunications industry.
Yeah, the megadata, where they collect everything.
Let me just say, look, it's going to be a BS speech. There's no question. It's already said that in the papers. Even the Times said it's going to be a speech about spirit and not so much about changes or reforms.
A typical speech.
And you know, Heidi, the point, though, about the metadata, which was, we talked about it here before, that the recommendation from the panel was it be collected and kept by the telephone company. Which is outrageous to me also.
I agree.
I mean, I found that to be ridiculous. What kind of thing is that? Why don't they just stop it?
Right.
Why don't they just stop it?
Right.
So, you know, even that reform, he can't even get himself to do that.
Right.
So the whole thing is just junk. And the part of it is it's really a speech that's trying to say, look, we're doing something and to lessen the tension in this country around those issues.
The one thing he's going to do. He's going to say, and probably also follow up and not do it anymore. He's not going to spy on the president of Germany. He's not going to spy on the president of France. He's not going to spy on the president of Brazil anymore. That much he'll give him. More than that, what's he going to give us? My prediction is zero.
No, this is why when I've written about it, I said the only way to get rid of this is to get rid of the NSA.
Right.
Destroy it root and branch.
Right.
That's what we have to do.
That's what Kennedy said about the CIA he wanted to tear it up into 1,000 pieces and scatter it to the winds. So let's do that to the NSA and the CIA.
Michael Smith. You just came back from Perón's home, Argentina.
I was in Buenos Aires with my compañera, Debbie Smith, and my son and his friend. We were in Buenos Aires, and then we went north up to the corner of the country in the Andes. But I wanted to tell you what we were able to do when we got there. We first met with Emilce Paz, who's the editor at Planeta Books. Planeta Books is one of the big publishing houses in Argentina. And she told us that the book, Michael, that we did, Who Killed Che? How the CIA Got Away with Murder, is being published in Spanish. The documents in both English and Spanish. It's coming out in September. And because this is a major publishing house, it's going to go out not only around Argentina, where Che was from, and he's a national hero there, but it's going to go out around Latin America and Central America as well. So, Michael, as you know, that was really our main intent. It was good that book came out 3 years ago in English, but we really wanted to see it come out in Spanish, and it was such good news.
Even if it's Argentinian Spanish, which sounds a little Italian, right?
Oh, you can't understand that. Instead of saying pollo, you know, chicken.
Pollo. Pollo.
Pojo.
Oh, pojo, right, right.
Pojo.
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 But there was another bit of news also that's extremely interesting and important. Starting in 1976 and lasting for 7-8 years, there was a military coup in Argentina. The leftists had some strength there, and the army couldn't stand it, and they overthrew the civilian government. They rounded up some 30,000 people, mostly young people, leftists, not terrorists, leftists. They called them terrorists. That sounds familiar. And they killed them. And they also stole the children of these people and sold them to rich people.
Those stories are badly and sadly known.
What I want to point out is that there are trials of these generals who did this and the business people who were complicit
going on
with them.
Now.
Going on now. There are demonstrations every Thursday in the Plaza de Mayo in downtown Buenos Aires.
There's hundreds of trials. There's been 200 trials in the last 10
still
years.
They're still going on. And we met with a person who had a real personal interest in these trials, which I'll tell you about in a second. But what I wanted to talk about was the information that's come out about the role of Henry Kissinger in all of this. You know, you can't keep a bad man down. This guy not only gave the green light to Pinochet to do a military coup in Chile, but it turns out, according to David Korn, who released the story last week, that Kissinger met with his counterpart in Argentina. And you can't make this up. The guy's name is Cesar Augusto Gutierrez. Cesar Augusto. I mean, he was the dictator in Rome after Julius Caesar. His namesake in Argentina met with Kissinger. Kissinger said, look, go ahead and do it. Kissinger really commanded him to do it. He said, round up these people and do what you have to do, but do it quick, because they've just passed a law in the United States saying that all aid is going to be cut off to human rights violators. So get your business done quick. And the irony is that because of the law in the United States, it actually sped up the detention, torture, murder, and child theft that went on in Argentina. So when we got down there, we were introduced to a Argentine film director and writer named Martin Salinas, who was a friend of Zach Sklar, who we've had on our program. Sklar wrote the screenplay to JFK. Well, his Argentinian counterpart is Martin Salinas, and Salinas has done a lot of films on the dirty war down there. And Salinas is married to a woman whose twin brother was picked up and disappeared. And this week, the trial of the general that killed Salinas's brother-in-law is going on. So my suggestion is to the government of the United States, be like Argentina. Put Kissinger in the dock. There's no statute of limitations to murder.
Our own co-host Michael Smith, Debbie Smith, and Francis Golden have assembled and edited an anthology of powerful essays titled Imagine Living in a Socialist USA. Prominent thinkers, activists, and artists have given their perspective of what the United States would look like if it was a socialist society. This new work is an important contribution to what we hope will be a broader movement. It includes an indictment of capitalism, an alternative America, and how to get there.
Imagine living in a socialist USA. We're here in our studio with the three editors, Francis Golden, Debbie Smith, and Michael Stephen Smith. And I'm here with Heidi Boghossian to talk about this important book, Imagine Living in a Socialist USA. Heidi?
Well, I'm so delighted that three of my good friends have come out with what is a beautiful compendium here. But I want to know the backstory. How did this start? Was this an informal conversation? How did this book come to be?
Well, it was my brainchild because I wanted to accomplish three things before I joined my ancestors. One was to make sure that everybody who lived in Cooper Square, who've been fighting Robert Moses and saving their old law tenements since 1959. It's been a tremendous long struggle. And whether they owned a studio or a three-bedroom apartment, every one of them paid $250 3 months ago to own their home, affordable rents for the next 198 years.
You're kidding. You won that victory?
Yes. It's 99 years with one renewal. That's 198 years.
It doesn't have to be the same person who renews it, does it? It can be your
family member.
It'll be the great-grandchild.
Okay, good, Francis.
And it's the only community land trust in the Northeast. The only one. And the only way you can keep a co-op from going private is if you own the land and they own the building. Everybody owns the building now. But if they get wise and they decide, hey, I want to move to Puerto Rico, but why can't I sell this for $500,000? And they could. We say to them, okay, you own the building, but we own the land. Take the building and bring it to Puerto Rico. And they say, how do I do that? And I say, that's your problem.
So if I understand this, what is that? The co-op owns the land so that therefore someone, if they want to sell their apartment and move to Puerto Rico, they can't.
They can't because we own the land.
I understand.
But the point is, this is one of your three dreams, and you accomplished this.
It's done.
What were your other two dreams?
And the next one is that I was really distressed with the direction in which our country was moving. It was really breaking my heart. Here I am, 89 years old, and all of a sudden North Carolina says that we're going to go back to the old days where you had to bring in your right arm and read the Constitution without missing a word in order to vote, and they went back 30 years. And that plus spying on every American and continuing the wars, it was just breaking my heart. And as my good friend Blanche Wieson Cook would say, give us socialism or give us barbarism. I consider it's either socialism or fascism, but whatever it is, I was very distressed that everybody thought that socialism was a dirty word. It was an undemocratic, terrible way of life, and they just didn't have a clue as to what it really meant. So I thought it would be a great idea if we pulled together the best minds in the country and let them talk about health, education, welfare, homosexuality, every subject that affects Americans' lives, and explain how it would be different under socialism if it were democratically done, which is the only way it should be done. And within 1 year, 31 leading brains in the United States, for no charge, they did it free, wrote their essays on each one of these subjects. And the book is in my hand. It's finished. And it's beautiful. And it makes me so happy. So that's my second accomplishment. And the third one, which I will also achieve before I die, is to see one of the leading intellectuals in the world free, forever free, Mumia Abu-Jamal. And that's a lot of work, and we're working hard on it, and we're going to win that one as well.
We are, Francis. Now, I want to ask you and Michael, why is socialism such a dirty word, before we get into more specifics about the book?
And this is Michael Smith we're talking about, a co-editor of the book with Francis and Debbie.
Correct.
Well, you know, I don't think it's a dirty word anymore, because I think people see what's going on under capitalism, and they don't like it. They think, well, socialism is the opposite of capitalism. I got to look into it. The Pew organization did a poll 2 years ago of young people and found out that 49% of young people under 30 in the United States have a favorable reaction to the notion of socialism. It's even higher amongst people of color. The Merriam-Webster outfit that puts out an online dictionary, last year, the two words that were looked up the most on the Merriam-Webster dictionary were socialism and capitalism. And just a couple of weeks ago, this wonderful woman in Seattle, Kwame Savant, got elected as a socialist, running against a Democrat, got over 100,000 votes running as a socialist for the city council in Seattle. That's a trend. I think that more and more, because the economic situation that we're in this country ain't going to change. It's only going to get worse. And we've got a threat of nuclear catastrophe hanging over our heads. Look at Fukushima in Japan. But more centrally, even than those two things, is climate change. People know that something very bad that could doom us is happening. And the only way to organize an economy so that you don't have the threat of climate change is a democratically run economy that doesn't continue to pollute the world.
Okay, now we have many, many, over 30 essays that go into different aspects. But I want to get back to, how did this book come about? Francis had a vision. Were you having informal conversations? How did you come up with the idea of asking these intellectuals and notables to do this?
I couldn't do it alone. It was a great plan. And so I leaned on two very dear close friends, Debbie and Michael Smith, and I asked them what they thought of the idea. And without a moment's hesitation, they said, "What a great idea." And they knew more people than I did internationally and nationally who could handle the various subjects that I wanted covered, which were at least 15 subjects or more. And while I knew a lot of the people, because they were my clients, like Francis Fox Piven and Juan Gonzalez, and a lot of the people were my clients.
Mumia, Angela Davis.
Absolutely. They're my clients. But they knew people in various parts of the countries that were specialists in the ecology, in law, et cetera. And we reached out to them, and there's not a single person who turned us down. Everybody was excited. They understood they wouldn't get paid. I want you to understand that nor will we get paid. I had to force HarperCollins into this. They really didn't want to do it.
Francis, can I tell that story?
Sure.
Because you're too modest. But Francis is really quite an influential literary agent in this country. She said to us, "Let's get a big bourgeois publisher to publish this book."
Because it needs money.
I thought, you know, I guess I'd be for that. I think the chances are probably zero. And all the books I've ever done have been published by small left-wing publishers. Frances is amazing. Maybe she can get it done. So Frances tried with one huge publishing house who was reputed to have a leftist head of it. And he came back to Frances and he said, "I can't publish your book because it's not balanced enough." And Frances said, "What are you talking about, balanced enough? What do you want me to do, put half the book about fascism?" So then Frances goes to HarperCollins. And they came back and they said, "Well, our marketing department did a survey and we can only sell 8,000 books." So I'm thinking, 8,000 books, that's more books than I've ever sold what I've done. But not for HarperCollins, it wasn't enough. So then Frances said, "Look, I've given you Barbara Kingsolver, one of the foremost authors in the country. I gave you a book called Goodnight Moon, that children's book that sold more books than any other book in the world except the Bible. And I'm not going to take no for an answer from you." So Frances is tough, and she leaned on him. They called her back, and they said, "Frances, come on in, and let's talk about whether we can do this book." So Debbie and I and Frances go up to their office over on 53rd near Fifth Avenue, and we go into the corner office of the executive vice president of HarperCollins, a British guy named Bingham. And we walk in, and I look around, and it's one of those huge offices with corner windows, and it's got a table and chairs as well as a desk, and it's got a couch. And on the couch are two pillows. One pillow has a drawing of Queen Elizabeth II, but the other pillow has a drawing of Karl Marx. So I looked at Mr. Bingham, and I said, "We're off to an auspicious beginning." And he laughed. So then I thought, "Oh, I'll push my luck." So I said, "You know, and remember now, HarperCollins is owned by Rupert Murdoch,"
right,
"the guy who also owns Fox News." So I said to him, "You know, Lenin once quipped that one capitalist would sell another one the rope to hang himself with." So Bingham says, "Yeah, I know that quote," and he laughed again. So then Bingham said, "What's your definition of socialism?" "A democratic economy and political system, both, where people from the bottom up control how we make a living and how we live." He liked that. So he said to Francis, "Will you take $10,000 as an advance?" And Francis said, "Only on one condition, and it put some money behind publicizing this book." And they did up a contract, and they promised to get it out right away, which they've done. They got their art department to do a beautiful cover called Imagine Living in a Socialist USA. And it's got a bunch of people holding up the map of America that says Imagine. It's all red, white, and blue. It's terrific. I want to invite everybody. We're having a book launch on January 27th. Get a pencil. It's at 126 Crosby Street in Soho. It's just south of Houston at the bookstore called Housing Works. Beautiful place, holds 300 people. There's wine and cheese. You can get a copy of the book. You can hear a bunch of us are going to speak. Juan Gonzalez will be there. Blanche Wiesencook will be there. Fran Piven, Francis, Debbie, me, Michael Smith. Check it out. It's called Imagine Living in a Socialist USA, and the book party is January 27th at 7 o'clock at Housing Works Bookstore in Soho, and we'll put that up on our website, lawanddisorder.org.
Let me ask, did you encounter any obstacles during the year or so that it took to put this together?
I don't think so. We were very lucky to hire an incredibly good editor whose livelihood was editing for magazines and newspapers. And what we asked him to do was to take these interesting, valuable editorials, statements, and remove all the academies that ordinary people don't understand. And if a sentence was too long, cut it into two or three sentences. Make it easy for students and normal people who read the daily news to understand. And he did a brilliant job.
We're talking with Frances Golden, Debbie Smith, and Michael Stephen Smith about their new book, Imagine Living in a Socialist USA. We'll be right back after this break. Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. If you're just tuning in, we're speaking with Debbie Smith, Frances Golden, and Michael Stephen Smith about the new book, Living in a Socialist USA.
You know, having read almost all of the book, this is not a dull book. This is an exciting and provocative book with short chapters that draw you in and into the hardest problems you might want to encounter. Why will it be a better environment under socialism than under capitalism? Why will it be better for people of color under socialism? And it takes on those issues, but in a way that's completely comprehensible. And so I loved it. And I think people will learn a huge amount and have a huge amount of questions and also see the possibilities when they read it. The editor really succeeded, not just a little bit, but really well.
We're talking about Steve Wishnia, who did this for us, and he also wrote the chapter on drugs.
The book is divided into three parts. The first is a chapter called What's Wrong with Capitalism? Quite good. A lot of us may know a lot of that, but it puts it there in a very, very succinct form. The second is Imagining Socialism, and it's a number of those categories that I've mentioned, that others here have mentioned. And the third section is How Do We Get From Here to There? Where do you want to start, Frances or Michael?
In order to achieve the kind of socialism that we're talking about, and that's socialism from the bottom up, you need a broad democratic movement of people. All the left-wing parties, all the movement groups, we've got to get together around a common program. One of the chapters, which I really like, and this is not to flatter you, Michael, but you wrote a chapter on what I would do as Attorney General. And it's the kind of demands and the kind of things you would do. That's the kind of things that we talk about in the last third of the book, How Do You Get From Here to There? So you put some demands on the government, immediate economic demands. Everybody should have enough to live on. Everybody should have enough to eat, clean air, clean water, housing. And Michael puts those out in terms of what he would do as attorney general. He says, it'd be a cold day in hell if they ever appointed me attorney general right now. But somewhere along the line, the kind of things that Michael suggests in his chapter, those are the kind of demands that we're going to make. I think that you have to look at it in terms of, in the United States, there have been two revolutions. And Paul LeBlanc writes his chapter about the third American Revolution. And if you look at it as it evolved, the first revolution was independence from colonial Britain. The second revolution was at least giving formally citizenship to black people. And the third revolution has to be an economic revolution. That'll be the third. And Paul LeBlanc writes about that. Diane Feeley writes about that in her chapter. She's an auto worker, retired from Detroit. She talks about what's going on there and what kind of demands you have to make to get Detroit out from under the situation they're in. Michael Zweig, the great sociologist, we reprint his speech from Occupy Wall Street, where he talks about the 1%, the ruling class. And he says, actually, it's about, you know, 0.1%. Those are the people that really are at the tops of the economy and the different organizations in this country that rule us and fool us. And he said, and you got to be very careful because these people will kill you. They have before and they'll do it again. And he talks in a very serious way about how you have to organize. So I think that the way we divided the book up into an indictment of capitalism, that was easy. I mean, we know what's going on. You just have to look outside.
I remember, Michael, when you talked to us about putting the book together, you and Francis and Debbie, you said everybody could write quite easily about what's wrong with the system we have. That we could sit here and write essays all the time. The question is, how do you take on what's wrong, and then how do you get there? And that was harder, and that's why the book is so important, I think.
Yeah, that question of imagination. I remember Karl Marx never wrote about what a future socialist society would look like. But that was 150 years ago, and we have a better idea now what it might look like. So we really attempted, and there are other people who've tried to do this also recently, but we really attempted to describe in the second part of the book, use your imagination. How do we organize the economy democratically? How do you organize a corporation? Rick Wolf wrote that chapter. How do you organize a corporation democratically? How do you organize so that when women go to work, they have an easier time of it? In terms of daycare and communal cooking and getting some help. There are 31 chapters in the book, and most of the book are these works of imagination in every area of life about how things would be different. And then, of course, the last chapter suggests itself, how do we do it? I think that the people, and there are 10 of them that contributed to that chapter, are all veterans of the struggle. You know, we're not against leadership. We're against undemocratic leadership, but you need people who have had some experience and who can draw the lessons of the past. We have people like that who wrote the last 10 chapters.
This seems like such a wonderful resource for students and young people. Exactly. Are there plans to go on tour or to share this, try to get it in academic institutions?
Absolutely. Already there have been people throughout the country who have welcomed us to come, either for the radio program or for a student body meeting. And we're very eager to do that. And it's not just the three of us, because all of the 31 people who participated are willing to lend themselves to go to these student groups and explain and answer the questions. Because right now, the word socialism is like people think of dictatorship. They think terrible things about it. They think undemocratic because they don't have a clue. And, of course, the powers that be want them to think bad things about socialism. So this is a simple instruction about how it would affect us with regard to health, education, housing, welfare, all of those subjects which make it so difficult for us to live. It's not a dirty word. It can't be. It happens to be the most democratic way of governing possible through socialism. Because even like when you talk about a company going bust, who knows better than the people who work there how to run that company? Kick out the boss. Kick out the people on the board of directors who make decisions that will only increase their profits. It has nothing to do with the product. It has nothing to do with the health of the workers. Get the workers to run the company. It's happening in Spain with dozens of corporations that have become worker-owned. They're doing wonderfully well. And I was very excited about the glass factory. I think it was in Chicago when that went out of business. Let the people who worked in that glass factory take over that company. Let them run the machines. Let them hire the brightest amongst them to be the manager. Let them hire the person better than the manager who can be the boss. And the boss every week will have to meet for half a day with all the workers to report how he's doing and hear from the workers how he can do better. Once the workers control it, there's not going to be one person putting all the money in his pocket and buying another piece of million-dollar artwork. It's going to be the workers who are going to divide the profits amongst themselves. It's a brave new world that we're talking about in Imagine. And first you have to move your imagination. And then if you don't move your rear end and get out on the picket lines and the demonstrations, it's not going to happen, because it will only happen when the majority of the workers are, but one, angry enough, and two, informed enough to know that they can run the show. Everything we do has to be to encourage people to get out and take over.
I wanted to just read you the titles of the first seven chapters in that second part of the book, Imagination. You get a feel for what we try to do. The future will be eco-socialist, because without eco-socialism, there will be no future, by Joel Covell. That's the first chapter, because it's the most important thought we could share with you. Then Ron Riosti writes a chapter, A Democratically Run Economy Can Replace the Oligarchy. And he talks about how you could actually run an economy democratically. This is not utopian. This is something we can do. And there are actually organizations now in the United States that kind of prefigure a democratic economy in the future. And he writes about those.
I mean, that's a brilliant chapter. I mean, because it takes on the question of worker control of a business or enterprise. But then how does that worker control not just do whatever those workers want that isn't necessarily good for the community they're living in? And so what Ron does in that chapter is try to take this democratic control, yet also have it be part of the community, society they're part of. And, of course, that is key. So it's not just top-down central planning directing workers, even in a, quote, socialist economy, to do what they do. And I think Ron's chapter really takes that on well.
Yeah, precisely. And then Rick Wolf, the Marxist economist, follows up with his chapter, The Shape of a Post-Capitalist Future, where he talks about how you can do that in capitalist corporations, how you can change them and run them by the workers. I did one on law in a socialist USA, where I talk about where law came from, because we didn't always have the kind of law we have now, and hopefully we're always not going to have it. And if you understand that law is a changing thing, you can understand how to change it. Then Mumia and Angela Davis did a chapter called Alternatives to the Present System of Capitalist Injustice. And then Ajamu Baraka, who's a friend of ours from the Center for Constitutional Rights, wrote a chapter called Socialism is the Highest Expression of Human Rights. And that's just the first seven chapters in that part. There are 18 more. So I hope listeners get an understanding of what we're trying to do. Again, let me, on behalf of Francis and Debbie, invite you to our book launch party, January 27th, 7 o'clock, at Housing Works Bookstore, 126 Crosby Street in Soho. It's just near 6th Avenue, kind of a block south of Houston Street. Housing Works Bookstore, 7 o'clock, Monday, January 27th. There's wine and cheese. Debbie Smith will be there. Francis Golden will be there. I'll be there. Michael Smith. Juan Gonzalez is going to speak. Fran Piven is going to speak. Blanche Cook is going to speak. You can have the book. It's just out. Come get the book. Give us a chance to say hello to you personally. January 27th, Housing Works, 7 o'clock.
Debbie Smith, as one of the three editors of Imagine, Living in a Socialist USA, I know you've been working on this book for quite a while and talking about it for quite a while, but what was your really primary goal in doing this?
We wanted to be part of a broader discussion that's taking place where we could put forward some ideas and questions to a, what is a very broad audience in the United States, among young people especially. We didn't think that this book was going to be a blueprint. This book was going to be part of this broad discussion, and we hoped that it would stimulate discussion. We don't have all the answers. This book provides some answers and a lot of questions, and we hope that people will be able to use it, form their own discussion groups, and be part of a broad movement. That was one of our hopes. I'd also like to say, I know this was reported on your show last week, that Lynn Stewart, our greatly loved friend, is out of prison. And Lynn wrote something for our book, right in the beginning of our book, and I wanted to read it because it is so beautiful. She says, "We go forward to preserve the air and land and water and sky and all the beasts that crawl and fly. We go forward to safeguard the right to speak and write, to join, to learn, to rest, safe at home, to be secure, fed, healthy, sheltered, loved and loving, to be at peace with our identity." I think Lynn says it all.
I would add one thing to that. It's a quote from Huddy Ledbetter.
Does Michael often add on statements after you finish, Debbie? I know he's your husband.
We're a team.
Okay, Smith?
I want to add one thought to what Debbie said, and that's a quote from 1936 when he was here. Huddy Ledbetter, who people know as Leadbelly, this great black Texas musician, came up to New York in the 30s and sang to integrated audiences organized by socialists. He had one song, and I'm going to give you a quote to it because
I think it follows up
what Debbie just said with Lynn's quote. Leadbelly's quote was, "Land of the brave, home of the free, I don't want to be mistreated by no bourgeoisie."
One of the things we want people to understand is that none of the people who participated got paid for their work, except for the editor, and that's Steve Wisniewski, and he did a spectacular job. But neither are Debbie, Michael, and I being paid royalties for this book. There will be royalties, and I think that HarperCollins will be surprised at how well this book is going to do. But every penny of the royalties will go to free Mumia Abu-Jamal. We are not earning one dime from this book. It was a labor of love. It was a labor of activism. It was a labor to change the world and make it a better place. It was not to earn money. We just want to make that clear.
I just wanted to add that at our book launch party on January 27th, which is being held at Housing Works, the books that are sold that night were donated by the publisher, and all of the money that is made that night will go to Housing Works to use for all of their very worthy efforts.
So it sounds like the process of publishing this book and spreading the word about it around the country is going to be helping in a very practical way many worthy causes, which I think is so fitting for what you're doing.
I think a new development that's happened in the past few years, which has given me tremendous courage, is Occupy. I think it changed the minds of millions of people once they understood the amount of money the workers get compared to the amount of money the bosses get.
You could even argue that Bill de Blasio became mayor because it became current for everybody that there was tremendous inequality
right.
in our whole society,
right.
New York as well.
Right.
And that's the ticket he ran on, and he won.
And I think that that inequality is what made the people understand, because of Occupy, of the difference between the 1% and the 99%.
And you know, Francis, when he was talking about the 1% and the 99%, he got red-baited. People told in the major media, they said, "Oh, you're a socialist." And the more and more they said, you're a socialist, the more and more votes he got. So he wound up as an underdog candidate. And by the time they got through red-baiting him about being a socialist, he won overwhelmingly. Another sign of the times.
I think so. But I think that we have to understand that this is not an easy thing that can be accomplished by a book or even by eloquent speakers. I think until we understand and make our compatriots, our tenants, our co-workers understand that the power in this country is ours. It's in all of us. When we band together, demand what we need, and then push for it. And that can take many guises. It can be a picket line. It can be wearing a button. I mean, on the front of my coat, it says Free Mumia, and on the back of my coat, it says
Tax the Rich.
Tax the Rich. And I've sewed it on so it won't fall off. There's ways that you can spread the word, but what it all comes down to is people getting together. Take the next step and read it. And then be empowered to know that in all of us is the power to make change if we act together in unison and don't take no for an answer.
There have been a lot of socialists leading or participating in progressive movements in America since the Civil War. The most famous American intellectual, Albert Einstein, was a socialist.
Helen Keller,
who from the time she was 2 years old, was blind and deaf, and who learned Greek and Latin at Radcliffe. She was a socialist. Malcolm X said, and Kazembe Balogun writes about this in his chapter, Malcolm X said, he goes around the world and he thought that people who are most inclined to not be racist, he said, were socialists. He said, you can't get a chicken to lay a duck's egg. And in America, you got this capitalist chicken. If that chicken ever laid a duck's egg, that would be a pretty revolutionary chicken. James Baldwin was a socialist. The wonderful poet and activist who just died, Amiri Baraka, was a socialist. Martin Luther King said that unless we have some kind of socialist democracy in this country, we can't have true justice. So some of the greatest men and women in our history were socialists. We don't learn about that in the schools because we don't control the curriculum of the schools. But you can learn about that in this book. Blanche Wiesencook has a wonderful chapter about women socialists.
So just to be clear, in 1 week from today, the book party will be held at Housing Works in Lower Manhattan. And are books on sale now?
Well, you can get them online. You can ask for them in the bookstore. But we're going to have boxes of them at Housing Works, donated by HarperCollins, thank you. And all the proceeds will go to Housing Works, which does such marvelous work on the AIDS front.
But it's very important to know that the only way the book will appear in bookstores, if it's each of you go into your local bookstore and say, I would like a copy of Imagine Living in a Socialist USA. Then they will order it. If more than one person goes in and asks for the book, they will order it from HarperCollins, and it'll be on their shelves. And if you do not ask for it, they will not order it. So you all have a job to do. Walk into your local bookstore and ask for a copy of Imagine, Living in a Socialist USA.
Francis Golden, Debbie Smith, Michael Smith, we are so thrilled to have you in the studio and to have learned about the genesis of this most critical book, Imagine Living in a Socialist USA.
And what I love about it, Michael Ratner speaking as one of the co-hosts, is how exciting it is. And I said it before, you won't be able to put it down. It's provocative, it's easy to read, and you'll love it.
Let me give John Lennon, who wrote the song Imagine, the last word. Lennon, who was a socialist, wrote, imagine no possessions, I wonder if you can. No need for greed or hunger, a brotherhood of man. Imagine all the people sharing all the world. You may say I'm a dreamer, but I'm not the only one. I hope someday you'll join us and the world will live as one.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.
Imagine there's no heaven. It's easy if you try. No hell below us. Above us only sky.
Imagine no possessions.